Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the speech given by Dr. Chandra Musafar at the November 2012 conference in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, called 9/11 Revisited, Seeking the Truth. And that'll be followed by a short article that I'm going to read. So first for Dr. Chandra Musafar. He is the president of the International Movement for a Just World. He's also the author and editor of 26 books in English and in Malay. He sits on the board of a number of international NGOs concerned with social justice and civilizational dialogue. He's a professor of global studies and science at the University of Malaysia. So here he is, Dr. Chandra Musafar.
Chairperson, Dr. Ghazali, fellow panelists, guests, Assalamu alaikum, salam sejahtera, peace be with you. I'd like to begin by thanking the Pradhana Global Peace Foundation for this very kind invitation. Let me at the outset express my very profound appreciation to Dr. Mahathir Mohamad for taking this initiative. It is an act of tremendous courage and integrity. As others have observed, leaders in power would not want to do a thing like this. But the fact is that leaders who are no longer in power also wouldn't dare to do a thing like this. So I think this is something which is commendable. All of us here, Malaysians, should be very proud that we have a person like Dr. Mahathir in our midst who's prepared to do a thing like this, because there are risks, without any doubt at all, for taking an initiative of this sort. Friends, you know the way in which public discourse is shaped by certain events. All of us talk of 9/11 and we have a certain 9/11 in mind. That's because this particular 9/11 had impacted upon the most powerful nation on earth. And so it impacts upon all of us. But we forget that there are two other 9/11s in history that we should also remember from time to time. One is the 9/11 that happened in 1973. 11th of September, the assassination of Salvador Allende of Chile, a democratically elected leader who was overthrown, assassinated. That's also on a 9/11. There's another 9/11 in history. 11th of September, 1901, when Mahatma Gandhi launched his Satyagraha movement in South Africa, non-violent resistance to power. But these are 9/11s that we don't remember. But let us, because of our theme this afternoon, concentrate on this very well-known 9/11. I began to have doubts about the official narrative on 9/11 just a couple of days after the event happened. And what was the reason? The media, including the Malaysian media, had at once come to the conclusion that the person responsible for 9/11 was Osama bin Laden. It was just amazing. No inquiry, no investigation, no attempt to find out the truth. All of a sudden, there was this person who was shown on TV over and over again as the person behind 9/11. And I could sense that there was something really fishy about this. Over the years, in the last 11 years, from the things I've read, the people that I've met, and from the very rich presentations we have had this morning, I'm more convinced than ever that we should make it our mission our life's mission to find out the truth about this very critical event in history, 9/11 of 2001. There are seven consequences which struck me as important in looking at 9/11, apart from all the other consequences that were mentioned this morning. Number one, the significance of 9/11 lies in the fact that it gave birth to the war on terror, which in turn impacted upon the relationship between two civilizations as never before, Western civilization and the Muslim world. It reinforced the stigmatization of the Muslim world, its association with violence and terror, which is not something that began with 9/11. It has a 1,000-year history behind it. Associating Islamic civilization with violence and terror has a long, long history behind it. It would interest us to know that when the European princes and the religious elites in Europe were conducting crusades in order to liberate Jerusalem, some of the literature, especially the religious literature that appeared at that time, castigated Muslims as violent people, when actually the violence associated with the crusades was unspeakable. They killed not just Muslims. In fact, they killed more Jews than Muslims in the crusades. And they killed Christians in the crusades, which is seldom highlighted. The Christians of Constantinople were massacred by the crusaders from Europe. So this was an example of violence, but somehow that violence was transferred to the victim. And this has gone on. You commit violence, you transfer it to the victim and say the victim is the one who is violent. And the classic example in our time is, of course, Palestine and what has been happening over and over again, especially in the last few days. Who are the violent ones? As far as the mainstream Western media and so much of Western society is concerned, the violent people are the Palestinians, when actually we know that they are the victims of violence. The real perpetrators of violence are somehow presented in a different light. So this has a long history behind it, and 9/11 reinforced that. Number two, 9/11 also reinforced the pursuit of hegemony. Hegemony during the Cold War had a certain rationale behind it. It was somehow the defense of the free world. But after the end of the Cold War, they needed to continue with their hegemony. So you create a new enemy, a point which a number of people have made this morning. And the new enemy is Islam or the Muslims, but also China. If you look at Huntington had talked about both these two new enemies that one had to confront. But in the case of the Muslim world, Afghanistan, the first target, and then of course Iraq, and one can argue Somalia and Iran, directly or indirectly, somehow related to the whole question of terrorism and of violence. But what it camouflages is not just the attempt to control oil and gas. There's something else as far as hegemony is concerned. It is to control sea routes. 8 of the 10 most important waterways in the world border the shores of Muslim countries, including the Straits of Malacca here, which is why they're also interested in regime change in Kuala Lumpur, because that would give them greater control over the Straits of Malacca. The Straits of Hormuz, the Suez, you look at all the major waterways, they are somehow linked to the Muslim world. So if you want to be a hegemonic power, you need to control these, just as you have to control oil and gas. And you want to control this, and this brings me to the third point I want to make, because some Muslims choose to resist, which is why you want to control. If they were not willing to resist, if they were prepared to play the game with you, there would be no problem. The biggest oil exporter in the world, Saudi Arabia, is prepared to go along with hegemonic power. So the Saudis are not a problem. But when you resist, it becomes a problem. And it doesn't matter whether you are a religious leadership, a very orthodox, perhaps even activistic religious leadership, it doesn't matter. Or if you're very secular, it doesn't really matter. The important point is resistance. The best example of this is Iran. Iran under Mossadegh resisted the British and the Americans. They had to get rid of him. He was secular. He was a nationalist. Iran under Khomeini resisted the West. And so they have continued to undermine Iran, religious. So it's not whether you're religious or secular. In fact, it does not even matter whether you're Muslim or something else. It's resistance. We have forgotten to highlight an area which has been subjected to U.S. hegemony and which has resisted for so long. And that's the resistance they've been trying to delegitimize all along. It's Latin America. Look at the way they've treated Cuba. 26 known attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro. That's the price of resistance. How they treat Venezuela or Bolivia or Nicaragua. So resistance is what the hegemon cannot accept. They have to delegitimize resistance. One way of delegitimizing resistance is to link it with violence. Because sometimes when you resist, you resort to force. For those under occupation, we know that resisting occupation through force is legitimate in international law. But nonetheless, you have to delegitimize their resistance. And this is the way to do it. You link it with violence, which is why we know that Ariel Sharon was Prime Minister at that time, 2001. Ariel Sharon was very, very keen on the official 9/11 narrative. To what extent he was responsible, we don't know. Something that one has to establish. But for him, it was delegitimizing the Palestinian resistance. It was saying, look, these Palestinians are terrorists, and telling the Americans, you also have a problem with terrorists, we have a problem with terrorists. This is 9/11, our bond of blood. It brings us together. And this, I think, is what is so dangerous about the official 9/11 narrative. An attempt to delegitimize legitimate movements against hegemony. Friends, there is yet another dimension to this. As a result of 9/11, a whole lot of militant groups have emerged in the Muslim world. I'm not referring to the legitimate resistance movements, all sorts of other groups. The most significant of them would be, of course, groups that are seen as allied to Al-Qaeda, with all sorts of names, and not just in West Asia, also in South Asia, Southeast Asia, these militant groups have emerged. And in a sense, some of them have given a bad name to Islam, these militant groups. Because they do indulge in senseless, mindless violence, which we should condemn. It is wrong. It's something that is unacceptable. But that's, again, one of the consequences of 9/11. And that brings me to yet another consequence of 9/11. Some of these groups are being manipulated, without any doubt at all, being manipulated by the centers of power in the West. They may be linked to the CIA, to Mossad. We don't know what other intelligence units that they are linked to, and that manipulation is very active. We have seen it in the last couple of years. Look at Libya. Some of the so-called jihadists were sponsored, openly admitted in certain media circles, sponsored by the centers of power in the West, intelligence outfits and so on. Look at Syria. Look at the active involvement of intelligence outfits from the West, including the United States of America, in Syria. Since March 2011, actually, if you look at the role of Saad Hariri and the role of Bandar Sultan and the way in which they had financed and sponsored terrorist groups in Syria, because that's part of the larger agenda, fighting against a leadership, whatever its shortcomings may be, and there are many shortcomings with the Bashar al-Assad government, whatever its shortcomings, We cannot run away from this fact that these jihadist groups and other militant groups who are all over the place in Syria now, they are fighting against a government that has been consistent in its resistance to the US-Israeli game in West Asia. So they have to get rid of the government in Damascus because of its resistance, because of its link to Hezbollah, because of its link to Iran. And that's what's happening before our very eyes. There is yet another dimension, friends, to 9/11, one of the other consequences. 9/11 has created a security syndrome that we have not seen before. It has become such an obsession, a security syndrome which denies human rights to people everywhere, in the West, in the East, the North, the South, a security syndrome which has diverted scarce resources from genuine, meaningful economic development to this thing called security, maintaining your security apparatus. A security syndrome whose outstanding characteristic is secrecy, as all security apparatuses, they are linked to secrecy, and that secrecy climaxed in the way in which the US SEALs killed Osama bin Laden. They killed the man and ensured that there would not be any trace of even his grave. And one wonders why. You believe in the rule of law. You believe in the judicial system. Why didn't you put him on trial? It would have been so easy to capture him and put him on trial. But they didn't want to do it because they had something to hide as far as 9/11 is concerned and what had really happened. And this brings me to yet another point about 9/11. Right from the beginning, many of us had observed that the underlying causes of terror and violence, if this was their concern, had not been addressed at all. And to this day, they don't want to address these issues because it doesn't serve their hegemonic interest to address the underlying causes. So friends, you have a situation where 9/11 has succeeded, in a sense, in tarnishing an entire civilization, in creating an artificial security syndrome, in legitimizing conquest and hegemony. Which is why those of us who look at events from the perspective of motives, if these are the motives, we ask ourselves, wasn't this a false flag operation? Because the motives seem to suggest that. That it was done deliberately, planned, contrived, implemented with certain goals in mind. A false flag operation. A lot of people find it very difficult, friends, to accept this sort of argument. How can it be a false flag operation? How can this be invented, manufactured? Are you accusing the government of doing this? Are you accusing the Israelis of doing this? How can you do this? This, I think, is the biggest psychological obstacle that we face when we tell people that there's something else behind 9/11. If I may, friends, let me, in my conclusion, draw your attention to a number of other false flag operations. We only came to know that these were false flag operations long after the event had happened. The most famous would be the Gulf of Tonkin incident of 1964. The US leadership at that time, Lyndon B. Johnson was the president, actually invented the Gulf of Tonkin incident. They alleged that US planes were being shot at by the Vietnamese, and that became the justification for a resolution in Congress known as the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution that gave the green light to Lyndon Johnson to begin the carpet bombing of Vietnam. And we know from records that have been made public after that, including biographies and autobiographies, that the whole thing was an invention to justify the carpet bombing of Vietnam and controlling the politics of this region. Look at another example, more recent. What happened in 1990-1991? When Saddam Hussein's troops invaded Kuwait, There was this story that went around that Iraqi soldiers had entered a Kuwaiti hospital, plucked babies, newborn babies from their incubators, and chucked them on the floor of the hospital. It was a lie. The whole thing was a total lie. The person who gave this so-called evidence before the US Congress, which later voted to go to war against Iraq, the person who gave that evidence was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to Washington, acting as a nurse, giving evidence before Congress. This had happened. Look at the Hawla massacre, very recent, what had happened in Syria. We know that it was a massacre committed by the other side. They put the blame on Bashar al-Assad's soldiers. The BBC carried this story as their footage. They used footage from Iraq. 4 days later, after they were exposed, the BBC offered a mild apology. So let us not think that the powers that be, this superpower, is not capable of doing certain things. They've done it before, they're doing it now, they'll do it in the future. Which is why, friends, it is so important to expose the truth about 9/11. It's going to be much more difficult than any of the other episodes that we have talked about, because the question of 9/11 hits at the very heart of global hegemonic power and the structure that maintains that power, which includes Israel and Zionism. Which is why there'll be tremendous opposition to any attempt of this sort. But we have to do it. We have to do it because we owe it, friends, to the millions who have died as a result of the war on terror. The millions who have died in Afghanistan, in Iraq, along the Afghan-Pakistan border, everywhere. We owe it to ourselves, because we know this is a monstrous lie. This is an example of a fabrication that has perhaps no other parallel or precedent. We have to fight this. We have to expose this. We have to do it, friends, because we are human beings and we owe it to our conscience. Thank you.
And again, you were just listening to the speech given by Dr. Chandra Musafar at the conference in Kuala Lumpur in November of 2012 called 9/11 Revisited, Seeking the Truth. You can see the video of the entire conference in Kuala Lumpur by going to YouTube and searching for 9/11 and Kuala Lumpur, and I would highly recommend that. It's a really historic conference, and I think we'll be hearing more from them in the future. Dr. Musafar discussed the death of Osama bin Laden in May of 2001 and how it was done in secrecy. And one of the reasons why it may have been done in secrecy is because there's lots of evidence that he died in December of 2001, only 3 months after 9/11. In David Ray Griffin's book, Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive, he documents the death of Osama bin Laden that was announced in a Pakistani newspaper in December of 2001, and also that the funeral service was attended by the Pakistani leader. He also reveals that the CIA had been listening in on Osama bin Laden's phone calls, and that in mid-December of 2001, all the chatter stopped and never started up again. So the real possibility that Osama bin Laden had already been dead for 10 years may be one of the reasons for the secrecy around the supposed second death in May of 2011. The second thing I'd like to mention about this is that there's no real evidence linking Osama bin Laden to 9/11, and I know that may be really difficult to take in, given all of the continual government and media accusations to the contrary, but here's what I can tell you about that. Osama bin Laden denied any involvement in 9/11 himself, and in 2006, a reporter for the Muckraker Report called the FBI and asked why they didn't have Osama bin Laden wanted for 9/11 on his FBI wanted poster. He was wanted for other things, but not for 9/11. Rex Toombe, the FBI spokesman, said that the government had no hard evidence linking Osama bin Laden to 9/11. Now, one would think that that would be front page news, but it was totally ignored in the corporate media. And now I'm going to read you part of an article written in the book called Solving 9/11, The Original Articles, by Christopher Bolin, and it's called The 9/11 Deception and the Death of Bin Laden, and it was written on May 2nd, 2011. And it starts out with a quote from President Obama. Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children. On nights like this one, we can say to those families who have lost loved ones to Al-Qaeda's terror, justice has been done. And he goes on in his article, when U.S. President Barack Obama announced that Osama bin Laden had been killed in a U.S. military raid in Pakistan, he repeated the unproven claim that bin Laden was behind 9/11, saying, quote, we quickly learned that the 9/11 attacks were carried out by Al-Qaeda, an organization headed by Osama bin Laden, and so we went to war against Al-Qaeda to protect our citizens, our friends, and our allies. And he goes on to write, while Presidents Obama and Bush both said the extrajudicial killing meant justice had been done, their sense of justice was very odd. After nearly 10 years, there has not been a single trial for any of the families of 9/11 to determine who is responsible for their loss, nor have any of the alleged terrorists behind 9/11 been tried in open courts, although they have been held for nearly a decade in Guantanamo, which is where Obama says they will be tried in Soviet-style closed military tribunals. The justice that Obama and Bush are bragging about is a gross perversion of American justice because it means condemning a person and taking their life without due process. After supposedly having killed bin Laden, the man behind 9/11, the U.S. military then quickly dropped his body in the sea. How much sense does that make? Why would the U.S. want to dump the body and destroy the evidence that they had really killed Osama bin Laden? Dumping the body of a murder victim in the ocean is what the mafia does with its victims to hide the evidence. This is not how a law-abiding nation should act. This is most unusual and raises obvious questions about who was really killed. After 10 years of searching for Al-Qaeda mastermind Osama bin Laden, why would President Obama announce that the terror master had been killed in a firefight with American Special Forces, announce that we have the body, and then dump the body in the ocean 2 hours later, before anyone can see the body or verify it? The British Prime Minister David Cameron repeated the unproven claim of Bush and Obama that Osama bin Laden was responsible for 9/11, adding that, quote, the man who was responsible for these appalling acts is no more. But was bin Laden really responsible for the 9/11 attacks and the demolitions that killed 3,000 people? There is actually no evidence that proves that bin Laden was behind the attacks, and a great deal indicating that 9/11 was a sophisticated conspiracy involving the intelligence agency of a state. While U.S. and British political leaders claim that bin Laden was behind 9/11, that's not what the FBI's most wanted poster says about him. It does not even mention that he is suspected of being involved in 9/11. Why would our political leaders claim that bin Laden was behind 9/11 if the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who collected all of the evidence from the crime scene, does not? On May 8, 2002, 9 months after the attacks, Robert S. Mueller, the director of the FBI, told the Senate Committee on the Judiciary, quote, in our investigation, we have not uncovered a single piece of paper, either here in the United States or in the treasure trove of information that has turned up in Afghanistan and elsewhere, that mentioned any aspect of the September 11 plot. Although the FBI supposedly collected the evidence from the 9/11 crime scenes, it has never presented any evidence that would prove that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda carried out the attacks. And again, that was part of an article from the book Solving 9/11, The Original Articles by Christopher Bolin. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.